Welcome back to part two of the Entrepreneurial Mindset with our brilliant guest, Rita McGrath. You're very welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I absolutely adored part one. I really enjoy the book. It's got so much in it. As I've said in part one, it is a playbook of how to run corporate innovation or how to even run a startup and select your ideas in the first place. If you're an existing company and you're looking for ways to step up your game, if you're looking for ways to differentiate, one of the ways you can do that is something we mentioned in part one. It was an article that Rita wrote before she wrote this book called Consumption Chain Analysis. And Rita says here, if looking at usage doesn't lead to a lot of great ideas, don't despair. There are many other places that you can do this. Enter a tool that Rita calls Consumption Chain Analysis. This works on the premise that opportunities for differentiation lurk at every step of the way your customers take. From the time they first become aware of their need for your product or service to the time they finally dispose of the remnants of the used up product. Customer consumption chains. Over to you, Rita.
So the idea behind a consumption chain is that you think about it as a consumer, right? There's always this swirl of activities around getting your needs met. And very often companies are not very aware of what the customer is going through. So if you think about it, take something really simple like getting groceries. But well, so I become aware that I have a need up. There's nothing in the house for dinner. I think about alternatives. Well, we could order some food. I could go to the grocery store. I could do whatever. And let's say I then settle on, well, I am going to go to the grocery store. And once I'm in the store, now I have to decide, well, what am I going to get? What looks fresh? What looks nice? What am I in the appetite to eat? What am I in the appetite to cook? I get my way through the grocery store, I get home, I unpack it, and all that stuff, right? So each step along the way is a moment of customer choice. And a lot of times we're very unaware that, firstly, that exists. Secondly, and this is a new bit of research that I've been doing, at each step in the consumption chain, there's a choice architecture you need to be thinking about. So how many choices are presented to a customer? In what order? How complex is it? How comfortable do they feel moving forward? What's the likelihood they're just going to freeze and not do anything at all? Because sometimes your most important competitor is the choice to do absolutely nothing. It's non-consumption. So the first thing that I recommend people do, and I'll revisit the idea that you want to be picking up on customers who behave differentially. So differential behavior on the part of the customer. And for that particular customer segment, let's map out how they get from link to link in the chain. Because what happens in companies is, because it makes sense to economize, you will have different parts of the organization involved with delivering different parts of a consumption chain. So if you think about it, who knows the most about that upfront part, the consideration, the awareness of need, the looking at solutions, who's in that consideration set? Well, of course, it's marketing, right? Who knows a lot about getting the customer signed up, their credit worthiness, how they pay, how you invoice them, that kind of thing. Well, clearly that's finance, right? Who understands what's going on in the field, how the thing gets delivered, how the customer actually uses it, what happens with disposal? That's your field service unit. You get the idea. And so what happens in companies is that even though we experience our experiences as an integrated whole and would like them to be served to us that way, companies break them up into different parts. And what can start to happen is there's gaps that merge between links in the consumption chain. And when you have one of those gaps, it's a business risk, right? Because what that means is the customer is now either confused, they don't know how to go on to the next link, or the next link is broken, or whatever. But it puts your business at risk if you don't have a complete and well-functioning consumption chain. Now, this is also where your ecosystem considerations come into play. And a very famous historical case at the time was, if you think about the Sony Betamax versus the consortium that produced VHS tapes, well, why did Betamax lose out? It's because of the complementary relationships. So if you imagine, I go to a video store and, you know, do I care what underlying technology there is? No, I want to go with the device that's got the greatest selection. And Sony didn't realize that, and they didn't court the content providers the way that they could have. And Betamax, of course, is a historically meaningful disappointment. But we see it everywhere today. And I think it's only become more important because today, customers, first of all, it's two-way communication, right? Customers will tell you if something doesn't work. You'll hear about it on social media. And it's much, much easier now to track customers' total journey than it ever was. So there's really no excuse for not understanding the steps in this consumption chain that your customer is going through.
thinking about what you said, one of the things I learned from you was the whole idea that snow melts from the edges, for example, and that you need to be in touch with all elements of the business. You need to have oversight and not just be seeing it from your own perspective. But there's this historical story of Volvo, and they had this specific colored green Volvo, and they couldn't sell them. So they dropped the price, and marketing marketed, sales sold it. Nobody told production. So production saw that these things were selling, so they made more of them. It's like, but it's just a brilliant story. I'm sure you've seen stuff like that yourself.
Oh, so all the time. And it's not that anybody means that. It's that we're looking at the world through our lens. I mean, a famous example I've used when I talk about learning from failure was the example of a company that was in business to decontaminate contaminated sand or water or whatever. And they were building these decontamination machines that industries would use to deal with their pollution and outcomes and stuff. And the government was about to pass this very strict new regulation, which this company's technology actually was perfectly suited for. They had just come up with this invention. It could meet the stringent government standards. It was great. This was in my doctoral years. I was doing interviews at the company with the different groups involved. And the first group of interviews I did was with marketing. And I said to the marketing people, well, what's going to sell this product? And got this whole story about how, well, there's going to be strict new government regulations. We're one of only one or two players who can actually meet that high level of standard. We're going to clean the floor with this thing because it's going to be just such a completely different environment. And I thought, well, okay, that story hangs together for me. So then I went and talked to the people in engineering. And I said, what's going to sell this thing? And they were like, oh, it's going to be cost, right? It's going to be efficiency. This is going to be the best working baby on the planet. And here's the thing that I thought was absolutely astonishing is the engineering people to meet their cost targets were engineering out product, the very capability the marketing people were counting on to sell it. So I went back to the marketing people and I said, have you guys talked to them? Like, and I would submit to you that waiting for a wandering doctoral student to come to your company to get ideas passed from one to the other is not a very efficient way of doing things.
It's amazing. It really is. And it goes back to something Joe Bauer told me, was that idea of resource allocation as well, is oftentimes it comes down to the individual because they'll back an idea of, oh, it's from Rita McGrath. Oh yeah, she's reliable. She delivered the last time. And it's not an idea meritocracy at all.
Oh no, I'm doing some work right now looking at women in financial services. And if you look at way in which that industry operates, it's not a meritocracy at all. It's who knows who, and if you think about who gets the plum clients and who gets the really good resources to add, it's all done through networks. And this is how human beings operate. We tend to affiliate with those that are like us. And those that are not like us don't tend to be embraced with the same enthusiasm. So if you really want to make a change happen in a sector like that, the change has to be structured. I mean, you've got to do things like allocate clients by an algorithm, not by who knows who.
Later on in this chapter, you talk about how do you identify the links in the chain? And you tell us here, any link in the consumption chain has differentiation potential. And your job is to find out which links are the most promising for your organization and why. I thought that, again, this is work that's not usually done. And even if you're a legacy organization, even if you're a cost center, there's still so much value you can add if you do this work as well. A great case study you show here where you're showing how do you even select a certain segment that you can go after beyond the usual segmentation that happens within an organization. This was a case study you shared in the book in automobile insurance. I'd love you to take us through this.
This was the case of Progressive, and one of the moves that they made that really put them on the map in automobile insurance was to recognize that the typical way auto insurance gets priced and sold is what the typical company is going after is the 85% of what I'll call standard drivers, right? So they own their own cars, they don't get in a lot of accidents. You can predict based on things like, did they go to college, what's their profession, la, la, la. You can predict how dangerous they are, and that's like the 85% of all drivers. But there's this remaining 15% that are, let's just call them higher risk drivers. So these are people, they tend to drive a lot of rental cars. They get in a lot more accidents. They drive recklessly. They do all this stuff. And insurance companies, as a general rule, just, you know, don't bring those people to us. They're high risk. But what Progressive started to think about was, well, wait a minute, is there something we could do with these drivers? And what they realized was because these people were in this particular category, they had no choice. They would have to pay a fortune to be insured. And so Progressive said, well, wait a minute, what if we created an offering that dealt specifically with the fact that these are higher risk people? And so what they started to build out was, they said, well, okay, how would we capitalize on an accident experience? And what they realized was that the typical way this gets done, first of all, it opens the door to an awful lot of fraud. There's a huge amount of fraud in sort of accident insurance reimbursement business. And so what they started to do was, they said, well, we're going to say, how do we create a really great experience for someone who's just had an accident? So they listed through all the negatives of what happens in that case. Well, I have an accident, we exchange insurance cards, that's my car can't be driven, it's got to be towed somewhere. Then I've got to figure out how much it's going to cost to get it reimbursed. Then there's a big argument with the insurance company about the repair costs. Then they want us to use their repair person, blah, 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 all this stuff. It's a really hassle, full of hassle experience. So what Progressive did was, they said, well, what if we had someone who's able in a mobile van? Now, again, this was pretty revolutionary at the time. In a mobile van, they've got everything that they need to assess the damage, identify the right place where the tow truck should go, give the customer a quote on the spot of what it's going to cost, and the customer can say yes or no, and then have somebody drive a loaner car to the location so that the customer can be on their way. I mean, transform the experience of having an accident. Now, we're not talking about a deadly accident. We're talking about the sort of stuff that everybody walks away from, but it's a nuisance because the car does have to be repaired. And so if you look at it in attribute map terms, right, that on the spot assessment, that turned out to blow people away. That was amazing. Getting a loaner was really attractive. Reimbursing the damage, of course, for an insurance company, you're supposed to do that. The negatives were, it was expensive, right? And what they really went after was the negatives in the classic insurance product. And so that was what their new offer did. And so what they were able to do was carve out this niche of high accident people. Now, once they started to do that, and this sort of brings the story up to the current, what you can then start to do is, you can now build up a database of where accidents are likely to happen. And we all know there are parts of roads that are high accident prone. There are badly designed intersections that tend to have a lot of accidents. So over time, you build up this database. And now what you can do is, you can have your mobile van actually waiting nearby for the statistically known time when an accident is likely to take place. It's remarkable when you think about it.
It's one of the things you talk about. One of the organizations you worked with was in manufacturing, because you make this very clear that you can use this in any sector. And even if it's in traditional manufacturing, you can use this. And for example, you said here, this company started to look at receipts payable, who were the laggards in being paid, etc. And they end up developing a capability from looking at that, from actually doing this consumption chain mapping as well. You mentioned GE did this, for example, as well, with laggard payers.
Yeah, you can make money on that. I mean, you can actually pitch to them, hey, if you want to take longer with pay, that's fine, you sign here, right?
One of the things you tell us here is that if you have a number of different customer segments, you can actually do a consumption chain for each of those segments as well. So there's even more work for you there to do as well, but we won't go into that. Next, I'd love to cover a third approach to capturing opportunities. And this is where you develop new business models, reshaping your competitive markets. And here you introduce the tool resegmenting.
Yeah, so sometimes the way a particular market's set up is just a function of historical. And so looking at it with fresh eyes, very often you can think of a way of cross-cutting traditional segments. And certainly digital technologies have made that much more much cheaper and much easier to consider doing. So if you just take an example we'll all be familiar with, if you take your phone, right, and you look at all the things the phone has basically replaced. I mean, I used to own a digital recorder and a flashlight, a camera, a digital camera, and I had, you know, sticks that you put your photos on. And well, what you've basically done with the introduction of these smartphones is you totally resegmented the demand for all of those things. And so, God help your standalone point-and-shoot digital camera maker in the world where everybody's taking photos with their phone, and the cameras on the phones have gotten really good. The phone use and the camera people are now collapsed. That segment's now collapsed into one. So that's an example of that idea of resegmenting.
With this idea of resegmenting, you mentioned one of your clients at the time who resegmented highly busy business professionals in the insurance segment. I would have loved the access to their product, by the way. Maybe you'll tell us about this one.
I was doing some work with Chubb at the time. They were supporting my dissertation, and I was doing some research on the Chubb organization, which is a very well-known insurance company. And I thought, well, rather than the sort of generic insurance we had on our home, maybe I should switch over to Chubb. So they don't sell, at the time they didn't sell insurance directly. So they put me onto one of their agents. So I call up the agent. I say, I'm thinking of changing my homeowner's insurance and car insurance over to a Chubb product. Oh, what should I do next? And so the first thing the agent says to me, oh, that's great. I can help you out. But I'll need to get some information first. I said, great. Why aren't you? What do you need? She says, well, the first thing I need is I need your husband's driver's license number. Now, I don't know about you, Abe, but like at the time we were both working and my husband's driver's license number is not something I carry around with me on a regular basis. This is during the workday. And he's not going to be abused by my calling him up and saying, honey, what's your driver's license number? And at the time we had two young kids at home. We had nannies. We had activities. We had, I mean, it was just, hey, you know, you walk in the house and I'm sure. And when you come home, it's orderly. The classical music is playing. Things are lovely. Yes. But when I would walk in the door, it's complete and total chaos. So anyway, so I put the phone down and I said, oh, I'll have to call you back. Now, what's just happened to the likelihood of that sale, right? I mean, like, why lead off with that? So anyway, I get my husband on a quiet moment. I have not, by the way, told him yet that I'm in the process of just checking out whether maybe we should switch our insurance. So now I have to go through the whole process of explaining that and why am I doing it? And my husband's very analytical. So what kind of information are you going to get just to get this driver's license number? I'm now being put through a torture. So then I am triumphant. I have the number. I call her back. And I call her back. She gets on the phone. I said, I've got the number. Here it is. Oh, that's fantastic. Now I just need a few more pieces of information. And I said, now what? Like, I've just been put through torture. Now what do you need? She says, well, what I want you to do is send me a photocopy of your current policy. Now, think about that. Like, back in the day, it wasn't like as simple as taking a picture of the page. I mean, you're condemning me to go to a copy shop or stand by my printer. And you know what insurance documents look like. They're long, they're thin, they're single-sided, they're two-sided. I can just hand it to somebody and have it copied. So what happened to that sale?
Enrager.
Not a...
Enrager.
It just didn't happen. Now, some years later, we had done a whole renovation and we actually did have to get our home reassessed for whatever its insurance would be. And so I was basically whining to my Chubb people about my poor experience the last time out. And they said, oh, we've got a broker for you who really gets it. She'll do your... So I'm like, with some trepidation, I'm like, this isn't the day when we physically call people. I mean, called her up. Sure, I can do that for you. When would be a good time for us to get together? And I said, I don't know. So gave her a time. She comes to my house. She's got one of those portable fax machine-like devices. She says, here's all... And she sent me a note after I put down the phone. She said, here's all the information you should have ready when I show up. She shows up. She takes pictures all around the house. She looks at everything we did. She looks at our documents. Puts it all in the system. It goes to corporate headquarters or whatever. Powers that be come back with a price. She says, is the price okay with you? And I'm like, sure. And she says, great, we're done. Sign yours. It took 45 minutes, maybe. And so, but my point though is the original person was not a bad person. What she was trying to do by asking me for a copy of my current policy is she wanted to come back to me and show line by line how much better the Chubb policy was going to be for me than the one that I currently have. And from my perspective, do I do a discounted cash flow analysis of my insurance policy? Probably not.
It's brilliant because you tell us there, anytime you spot a difference in behavior, you may be looking at an opportunity to resegment. And that's a perfect example of it. And when you see what happened with the working world, where everybody's working from home now more increasingly, the world's changed entirely from a working perspective. There's lots of opportunities to resegment, but organizations are sticking back to the way they've always done it. Hence, look at this book, and it gives you this totally different way of looking at things. This brings us to your second recommended approach to transforming a competitive arena. And maybe you'll tell us about that term as well, because I learned about that first when I looked at the end of competitive advantage. But you say breaking down the barriers that cause the current market to be structured as it is important, because this is what you call market reconfiguration. And you tell us also here, there's a lot in this, there's three types of reconfiguration: evolutionary, radical reconfigurations, and then revolutionary reconfigurations.
Yeah. So if you think about how something we call an industry is structured, it's generally set up the way it is because there were a set of constraints in place that meant it had to be that way. So if you take something like the automotive industry, right? Well, to be what it is, you needed tons of regulations around what a car could be. You needed governments providing key infrastructure like highways. You needed private firms like oil companies creating petrol stations, gas stations. You needed this whole complex of things to operate together to create an end use where you can buy a car, fill it up with gas, and off you go. And so when you start to see the ability for something really different to fulfill that same need or to take place of that existing structure, that's when the opportunity for an industry reconfiguration is happening. Now, that's happening in automotive, but it's happening very uneven. So we're seeing now electric vehicles becoming a big part of the ecosystem, and that's going to be very destabilizing. Now, why is that? Because electric vehicles, unlike internal combustion engine cars, have far fewer moving parts. They don't have a big, heavy engine the way that a gas-powered car does. And when you think about who in the ecosystem that's going to have an effect on, it's all those little service stations, because that's where they make all their money. The car dealers make all their money on repairs, basically. So you're going to see a radical shift in value in the segments that service that industry, because it's not going to be the whole function. It's not necessary anymore. Likewise, there's this debate right now. Well, are the charging stations going to be like gas stations are today or like petrol stations are today, where there's a central place where you have to go? And the early Tesla designs presume that. They presume you're going to go to this place. While you're there, maybe you'll have a snack and a drink while your Tesla's charging, and then you'll leave and go up. But there's an alternative perspective, which is actually, no, why would we do that? Electricity is everywhere. Why wouldn't we just have distributed charging stations so that you don't have to go to a central place? So you can make an appointment for parking lot B and just charge your car while it's doing that. Or if you know that there's going to be a number of different users at a particular location, you just set it up at that location. So you can just see the whole industry really shifting. Another big one that I'm looking at right now is if you think about how medicine is distributed in the world. What used to have to be done in a doctor's office increasingly is getting distributed. So you used to have to go to a doctor's office to get blood drawn or to get an EKG or to get any of these things. Now, a lot of times you can do that at home. You used to have to go to a hospital if you needed to be infused and say a chemotherapy drug. That used to have to be done in a hospital. Today, they send you a thing and you can inject yourself at home. It's astonishing. So that's a signal that an industry is ready.
So maybe we'll go through the three different types. There's evolutionary, radical, and then revolutionary. I love the terminology there.
Well, evolutionary change is just the next logical step in the development of a sector, right? So if you think about food, an evolutionary kind of change would be, all right, well, we're going to go from food that used to have lots of processed chemicals in it to food that's now being advertised as chemical-free because there's a demand that's opened up in the market. That's an evolution, right? Cereal that's now got no heavy sugars in it. Well, it's still cereal and it's still in a box and we still know what cereal is. So that's an evolutionary change. A revolutionary change is where something's being done in a way that's quite differentiated. So if you think about the shift in breakfast time, right, let's say, and how cereal has really lost out to other more affordable mechanisms of food consumption, this probably goes back to pre-pandemic when a lot of people were commuting, and it ties to a conversation we had earlier about cup holders. Well, once you've got cup holders in a car, and the car is in many cases, for many families, it's like the living room. It's where everybody is. Well, sitting down and having a bowl of cereal is not very conducive to that environment, but opening a snack bar could be. So that's more revolutionary. It's saying, hey, wait a minute, the fundamental assumptions on which this thing is happening are different. And then the really disruptive thing is where an entire category gets displaced. You know, so we used to do it this way, and now we're doing it that way. And I've used the example of phones displacing many other categories. Before that. So those are the three tips.
One of the tools that you're very au fait with, but I'm increasingly surprised by how few people actually use it, is the five whys. And you use this a lot of the time throughout the book, for example, questioning your barriers. And you give an example of Citibank here, question barriers. And this ultimately led to them moving their credit card business to a different state by using the five whys. Maybe you'll share that as a final message.
It's a hilarious story, actually. So it all began with, don't often know this, but you know, the credit card industry as it emerged was a very bespoke kind of thing. And it started off with things like diners club. So very affluent people would have a thing called a credit card, which meant you could give it to a provider and they'd provide you a service or whatever, and then you'd pay for it. And the credit cards back in the day were all very scattered. They were either department store credit cards or whatever. We didn't have universal credit cards the way that we thought of them now. And the first company to really try to make a go of it was Bank America. And Bank of America created this thing called the Bank of America card and tried to get other banks to buy into it as a way of accepting payments. And of course, Bank of America would take a cut then. And then some bright marketing person figured out that Wells Fargo was highly unlikely to be promoting a card called a Bank of America card. And so what Bank of America decided to do was rebrand this to Visa. And there was a whole bunch of other stuff happening at the regulatory level that made this possible. But, and then they did a big advertising campaign. So they said, oh, Visa, next best thing to slice bread. It's great. You can use it anywhere. Universal credit card. Terrific, right? And so they really heavily advertised this Visa card. Now, Citibank had been dabbling in the consumer credit experience a bit. And when Bank of America did this whole rebranding to Visa thing, they were sort of part of that. But then what Bank of America did, which was turned out to be the fatal flaw, was customers would become convinced that this was a great thing. They had to have it. They had a Bank of America card. And they'd call up and they'd say, wait, how can I get my Visa card? And Bank of America would tell them, oh, we'll give it to you on your next card renewal. The typical customer is going to have to wait 6 months or longer to get this thing that Bank of America has now told them is the greatest thing since sliced bread. So Citibank saw an opportunity and they pounced on it. And what they did is they took out these full page ads saying, if you want your Visa card today, we'll give it to you. And people, customers were like filling out the newspaper applications and sending it into Citigroup. And so on the one hand, enormously successful entry, and the guy that was in charge of it at the time said, this was fantastic. But this was in the late 70s. And most of your listeners either won't have experienced or will have forgotten this. But interest rates in the late 70s were in the 17% range. I mean, that was normal. And most states, including New York State, where Citibank was located, had what they called a usury law. And a usury law meant there was only so much interest you could charge. And I think at the time it was capped at like 10%. So Citibank had succeeded in getting all these Visa cards into people's hands, but then they would promptly run up to the credit limit, which was $500. And now all this money sitting out there and the amount of interest Citi has to pay on the money is higher than the amount of interest they can recapture in terms of payments from the customers. It was just a horrible situation. And New York State had these usury laws, and that was just, that was what it was. So they were desperately looking for a way out. And Citigroup has this interesting, at the time, had this really interesting legal department. And the legal department, among the things that they would do, is you'd go to them and you'd say, how do I get rid of this regulation or this law? And they'd give you a price tag of what they thought it cost to do it. But anyway, so out of this mess came the governor at the time of South Dakota. And South Dakota had been suffering from losing a lot of industry. Things were not great. And he basically sat down with the head of Citibank and he said, look, I think I can make this work. I think I can get our legislature to get rid of usury laws. But in exchange, you need to move your operations to South Dakota. And that's what happened. He persuaded the legislature that this could be a whole new source of business. At the time, they would have been the only state in the nation that didn't have some limit on what interest you could charge on a credit card. And it succeeded. The Citibank took its whole operation and moved it to South Dakota, charged high interest rates. And the governor of South Dakota, the only thing he did weren't take into account was the motivation of alternative governors, because the governor of Maryland then promptly went and did the same thing. And Maryland being much closer to a lot of the money center banks, he scooped up some of that business. But Citibank's in South Dakota to this day. And that's how that came to be. Now, another interesting twist to that story is, so they were able to charge these incredibly high interest rates. So if you have a regular credit card and you don't pay it, don't pay the full amount, you get charged a big wad of interest on that credit card. So the interesting, almost ethical moment came when interest rates started to come down again. The big question at Citibank and many other banks was, well, do we bring our interest rates down to reflect what's going on in the broader economy? And the answer was, well, actually, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep our 1970s era 26% or something interest rate charges on unpaid balances because it's very profitable for us. And the consumers at the time, they made it very difficult for consumers to see what the actual cost of that was. And so you'd hear students saying things like, oh, well, yeah, I can buy that TV. It's only going to be $5 a month. And when you look at the interest rates there, I mean, it's just, it's a lack of financial education being taken advantage of by these institutions. Now, this is now, of course, on the crosshairs of today. Many entities are saying this is not fair to the average consumer. It's damaging to the economy. It's not a good practice. So I suspect that's going to come under more and more pressure.
Wow. Well, brilliant, Rita. And again, I'll share links to this and share links to all your website, et cetera, because there's so much in this, including how Citibank actually got to that through using the five whys technique throughout the book as well, really gives all these questions that you pose to yourself to question your assumptions, which is a huge part of Rita's work as well, because we have this way of working that's been successful, that's no longer successful as well. So we have these reams of questions that Rita offers, but very specific for different parts on the stage of challenging your assumptions as well. Rita, it's always a massive pleasure. Where is the best place for people to find you, find more about your work and also the tools that you offer?
Sure. So a good place to start is my website, which is ritamcgrath.com. And if you want to see upcoming events, just click on the events tab. If you want to look at my article archive, it's under a document called Thought Sparks. So as the name suggests, these are things I write to sort of spark people's thinking, and they're things I think are interesting. But there's also a wealth of other material on the website about me. It's links to videos and so forth. I have an ongoing archive on YouTube videos, including fireside chats and LinkedIn lives and all kinds of things going back years. So you can find all that at ritamcgrath.com. And then if you're interested in the tools that we've been developing, a good place to go for that is valise.com, which is my sister site that's intended to make it possible for you to implement these things inside your own organization. So that's what Valise is really founded to help do.
Fantastic. And we have so much more to cover as well. We've only got through a little bit of this book, only about halfway through. And we've those other books on the shelf there behind me as well to come. It's an absolute pleasure spending time and learning from you. Author of The Entrepreneurial Mindset, Rita McGrath, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.